are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 24th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ryan Devereaux of The Intercept on how the government puts you on the terror watch list. Also on the program today, Paul Ryan's plan comes out to help poor people by telling them you shouldn't be poor. Also on the program today, Israeli shells hit a UN shelter in Gaza. Another botched execution took 2 hours for the inmate in Arizona to die. Meanwhile, in Iraq, ISIS calling for the genital mutilation of all women in Mosul. Senator John Walsh from Montana, who replaced Max Baucus, claims that PTSD was the cause of his plagiarizing his master's thesis. That and more on the program. Random Rush coming up in the better half. Sorry?
You cannot say he went small on that excuse.
That's true.
I like that.
That's true. Wanted to start off with, while I was at Netroots Nation, we spoke to a couple of people about what was going on with the water situation in Detroit. And we spoke to, I think, Chris Savage of the Collective blog. And we also interviewed a couple of members of the Detroit Water Brigade, which function to help people who are trying to get basically the basic bare minimum of what you need to exist, water, in their homes. They also supported the water warriors, who were the people who were taking direct action, trying to prevent the trucks that were being sent out to shut off people's water from actually reaching their destinations. Following the protest that took place that week during Netroots Nation, there was a 15-day moratorium put on shutting people's water off. Meanwhile, some other members of the Detroit Water Project, or I should say some other people just set up something called the Detroit Water Project. You can go to DetroitWaterProject.org and you can offer to pay part of or the entirety of different people's water bills in Detroit. You put your email address in there and then they email you back after they've attempted to match somebody up with your pledged donation. That is DetroitWaterProject.org. Now we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Ryan Devereaux of The Intercept on the secret government rule book for labeling you a terrorist. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ryan Devereaux, reporter with The Intercept, on his piece co-written with Jeremy Scahill, The Secret Government Rulebook for Labeling You a Terrorist. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
So this report that you wrote with Scahill is based off your acquisition I guess it was like a 166-page document. What was that document?
Yeah, so the document was prepared last year by the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, which is responsible for managing, consolidating all of the government's information on known or suspected terrorists. The NCTC manages the government's largest repository of information on those individuals, a huge database called TIDE, and that database is used to sort of fill the watch list, which is an unclassified database that is accessed by law enforcement, foreign governments, private entities. The TIDE database also feeds into the no-fly list that everyone's heard of, and the selectee list, another travel list that causes travelers to be subjected to expanded screening at airports and border crossings. So what the guidelines which we published lay out are sort of the rules that the government uses for labeling someone as a known or suspected terrorist, a process that they call nominating or nomination, and sort of how those nominations make their way into the various databases and watch lists, and how that information is shared, you know, throughout what they call the watch listing community. This is a document that, as I said, was prepared last year. It's the most recent up-to-date rule book for how all of this stuff works. And for years and years, lawyers, privacy advocates, and, you know, private citizens who felt they'd been wrongly watchlisted, added to the no-fly list, et cetera, have, you know, gone to court trying to understand how this works, what the rules actually are. And the government has fiercely defended making its rules public, even though the document that we published is unclassified for the information.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, so what does that mean? So it's unclassified, but the citizens can't see it.
Exactly.
Is there a classification for that? I mean, there must be some type of classification. Like, what does the government call that? If it is not classified, but also not something that people outside the government can see.
Right. So it's unclassified for official use, sensitive security information. So this is basically information that's supposed to be shared on a need-to-know basis. The reason that it's unclassified is, as I said, the watchlisting process, the process that the U.S. government participates in with private entities and with foreign governments. So they need to share some of this information about the rules with their partners within the watchlisting community. So this thing, you know, the U.S. government loves to classify as much as possible. They're frequently criticized for overclassification, but they couldn't classify this particular document because they need to share some of the information that's in it. That said, they fought extremely hard and successfully to keep these rules secret. Just a couple months ago, Attorney General Eric Holder invoked the state secrets privilege, a power that the Obama administration relies on to keep many of its counterterrorism programs under wraps. He invoked the state secrets privilege in litigation in a case involving an American who is on the no-fly list in order to keep the government's rule book secret. But this is unclassified information, and it directly impacts, you know, scores and scores of people, and has for, you know, more than a decade, you know, since 9/11. So, you know, this is a document that's very, very pertinent to a lot of people and really matters.
Right. And before we get into sort of the details of it, I mean, on its face, at least, and maybe there are other examples of this, but I'm not, they don't come to mind. There's something sort of inherently problematic, right? Because if a document would be classified, but for the fact that we need to share it with so many people, in other words, I mean, we need to, the idea being that, you know, generally, when we think of something as classified, it is because there is a very narrow group of people who should have access to this, because we have a very controlled plan, or we are trying to execute something that is very narrowly tailored. In this instance, it's like, well, we may need to send this to this is a bit of an exaggeration, hopefully, but it's not like there wasn't tips. They attempted to do something called tips about 12 years ago. We may need to share this with postal carriers so they can put their input into this. So it can't be classified, but for the vast apparatus that we need that will basically impact someone either being placed on this list or being subject to the fact that they are placed on this list. So with that said, let's go into the details here. We know that there's what you said, 16 different organizations that basically partake in the nomination process.
Well, the cover of the document bears the crest of 19 different agencies and departments, including, you know, the members of the intelligence community, you know, the military, and then the actual watch listing system is comprised of all of those actors, as well as, tribal authorities, certain private partners, foreign governments. We know that the U.S. government participates in sharing watch listing information with at least 22 foreign governments. So it's a big group of sort of entities participating in this whole system.
Okay, so who are the private partners?
It's a great question. We put that question to the NCTC when we went to them, telling them that we were going to publish this document, and it's not a question that they answered. One can sort of guess that this would probably include private contractors involved in the intelligence community in some way. You know, intelligence contractors make up a significant portion of the intelligence community. The intelligence community relies heavily on private contractors to do a lot of very sensitive work.
Yeah, I mean, that also seems a little bit troubling, because theoretically, though, it could also just be, businesses. I mean, it seems to me, let's go through what the standards are here, because, one of them that really jumped out at me was defining terrorism as any act that is, quote unquote, dangerous to property. I don't know what that means.
Well, and the guidance doesn't give you a lot of clarity on what they mean by that. And that's true with so many passages in the document. It seems to be so broad that you could really apply it, you know, with the right sort of argument to just about anything. Dangerous is a completely broad term, but it's one that apparently the government uses in its process for labeling people known or suspected terrorists. They don't need to have a lot of proof for it. They only need to have reasonable suspicion.
Yeah, well, let's move to that in a second. But, you know, when I see dangerous to property, what is unclear to me is it government property? In other words, if I am Reverend Billy from the Stop Shopping choir, and I go into a Chase Bank and I am beginning to sing in there, contrary to their wishes. Do I represent a danger to that property And is that enough for some official to say to nominate me to be on the terror watch list?
As the rules are written, it seems that that certainly could be the case. I mean, the government has a lot of questions that it needs to answer about how this stuff is actually applied, because the sort of situation that you posit there certainly seems like it would fall within the realm of what these rules permit.
All right, so let's go back to the standards of even how that the standard in which one even judges whether or not one could be dangerous to property. So it's this notion of reasonable suspicion as opposed to something like probable cause. But talk about that.
Yeah. So here in New York City, I covered pretty extensively the sort of controversy around stop and frisk with the New York City Police Department. And the stop and frisk regime is based on this same standard, reasonable suspicion. It's an incredibly low legal standard that just about any law enforcement official will tell you, just about any cop can come up with a reason, a reasonable suspicion reason to stop somebody. This same standard is at the heart of the watch listing process, the terrorism watch listing process. So it is essentially, it's not probable cause. It's not something that a court could ever convict you on. It's an incredibly, incredibly low standard.
And so this... It's a reasonable suspicion standard for determining whether or not someone's a possible threat. And then you guys write, the government tracks suspected terrorists as well as known terrorists. Individuals can be watchlisted if they're suspected of being a suspected terrorist. Now, that's
exactly.
When you are suspected of being a suspected terrorist, it's like you need to have just, I mean, that. The suspicion is diminished by half, right? I mean, that in terms of the threshold.
Right, exactly. And we're not only talking about known or suspected terrorists here. I mean, this stuff also applies to associates, people with a so-called nexus to terrorism. You could be suspected of having an undefined nexus relationship to a nexus to terrorism, and then get on one of these lists, and then your name is on the list, and then the government can put you, move you from the TIDE database into the broader unclassified watch list, which is accessible by law enforcement and private entities, and then some cop can pull you over, run your name, and see that you are on a list that has the word terrorist up at the top of it. And that's all based on a reasonable suspicion standard and a vague relationship to an undefined nexus. But it's fairly startling.
And then there's the guidelines define destruction of government property in addition to being dangerous to property generally. And then damaging computers used by financial institutions. These activities, what does that mean, damaging computers? I mean, like literally go in with a hammer?
Like actually, It doesn't specify what that means. One could guess that they're probably referring to hacking here. This could have, implications for so-called hacktivists and that sort of community, online activists. But it doesn't specify, whether this is a sort of like, taking a club to a hard drive, like, UK officials did to the Guardian's computers over the Snowden stuff, or if this is, hacking. We don't know.
So you get on this list, the government, what's really also problematic about this is a 166 page document that, that is supposed to be in some respects executed. Like, it seems to me that if they need to disseminate this thing so widely that it can't be classified, that this is a game of telephone. So, if you start with the parameters that anybody who's suspected of being a suspected terrorist, which could include even any act that is dangerous whatever that means, to property in general. By the time this gets down to the person who has the ability to put you on this list, I mean, like, just how down the food chain can someone nominate you? Does it have to be, does somebody at the airport who's checking our bags as we go through, do they have the ability to nominate somebody? Does a banker who says, you know, the Stop Shop Inquirer was in my bank today, who do they call to nominate somebody?
Yeah, so as the guidance defines it, nominating agencies are executive agencies and departments, and they are all responsible for and are required to share any terrorism information that they come across with the NCTC. So once they share that information, if NCTC validates it, then that agency or department becomes a nominator in the sort of lingo that they use. And then the nominator is responsible for informing NCTC if they come across any information that should be used to sort of update the person that they nominated, update the sort of file on the person that they nominated, or any information that they come across that could get the person removed from the database. Now, if let's say the FBI has nominated somebody and the CIA comes across information about the same people, the FBI is the original nominator, the CIA puts in some information about that same individual, the CIA also becomes a nominator, and if the FBI believes that that person should be taken off the list for whatever reason, the CIA has to agree with them. So, you know, once different agencies provide information on the same individual, if one of those agencies wants to remove that individual, they all have to agree.
But who is limited? You know, who is limited to being a nominator? I mean, the FBI nominates. That seems fairly obvious. The CIA. Who are the other agencies?
The entire intelligence community is involved in this process. The military is involved in this process. But there is a distinction between the nominators and then the screeners, right? So, you know, a screener is someone who is checking the information, basically they have an encounter with someone who they think may be a known or suspected terrorist. They check against the government's database, and then it turns up whether or not that person is in the list, and the screeners are different than the nominators. But the nominating community is all executive departments and agencies.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at, like, the top of, is it just those people, just those organizations that have their emblem on the front page, the watch list guidance? I mean, you know, I can't tell who they all are. There's a couple of planets on their emblems.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a bunch of eagles. Yeah, it's all just basically eagles, shields, and planets.
It's very, very, very patriotic. I mean, it's DHS, TSV, all the branches of the military, NSA, CIA, FBI, DEA. I believe the Department of Department of Treasury is in there. Department of Energy. It's a whole host of, you know, acronym agencies.
Okay, but it's not, let's say, the EPA. I mean, it's not. You can't go that. It doesn't go to every executive agency. Doesn't have the ability to nominate, right?
Well, the way that the guidance lays it out, right in the beginning of the guidance, it says all executive departments and agencies.
And so we don't know if there is an apparatus in which any government agency, the Social Security Administration, has the ability to nominate you. I mean, we don't have a sense of that, do we?
No, we don't.
Okay. Apparently, according to you guys spoke to a spokesman from the National Counterterrorism Center. They said no one can be placed on a list solely for activities protected by the First Amendment. That raises another question that actually came up with the recent story that that Greenwald broke on the naming of names, which is. It appears that First Amendment activities can't be the sole justification but that they can be part of a broader, you know, I guess your broader CV as to whether or not you should be nominated.
Exactly. They say solely, but that doesn't mean not, right? You can the way that the guidance lays it out says that you cannot be nominated solely for First Amendment, protected activity, but First Amendment protected activity can be part of a nomination if there's other information involved that can be, you know, reasonable suspicion-based information.
So, in other words, if you are protesting outside of a honey-baked ham plant, and you're a vegan, and there's some question as to whether or not you could be dangerous to property, those two elements, one, that you protest, two, that your proximity to the fence at the honey-baked farm, I mean, theoretically, right? I mean, that, and I guess that's the problem.
I guess that's the problem with this, right,
is that theoretically, it seems that everything is possible.
Right, right. That's exactly the sort of impression that you get when you go through this guidance line by line and think about what they're actually saying here.
And then there's this the different types of data on what they call suspected terrorists. There's derogatory information, substantive derogatory information, extreme derogatory information, particularized derogatory information. Who oversees all of this? I mean, it seems to me
it's
like
a great question.
You don't know? We don't know who oversees.
Well, no. It's a fantastic question, and I say that because in 2012, Government Accountability Office (GAO) issued this sort of scathing report based on 2 years of looking into the watchlisting system, interviewing people that were part of the watchlisting system, and one of their biggest critiques of the way this whole thing works is that there is no entity responsible for looking at the watchlisting system as a whole and determining whether it's living up to the sort of standards that one would think the system should be adhering to. There is no entity responsible for making sure this thing is doing what it's supposed to be doing. The GAO has been issuing reports like that about the watchlisting community for years. It's, you know, inspectors general from across the intelligence community have been criticizing this system for a lack of sort of oversight and clarity. There's nobody making sure that this whole thing is working.
So let me see if I have this right. The DHS sets up these databases, essentially. They have the terrorist screening database. They have the terrorist identities data mart environment. And then there's no agency within the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security that is responsible for auditing this process, for streamlining. I mean, who draws up this guidance? I mean, I know there's input from these 19 agencies, but when it's drafted, whose office are they sitting in?
Okay, so, well, DHS is actually not running TIDE and is not running the TSDB, the watch list. So TIDE, the largest repository of terrorism information, is managed by NCTC, who prepared this document, who's, you know, sort of responsible for this document. And then the actual watch list, the TSDB terrorist screening database, the unclassified database, that includes the information that's shared broadly. It is run by the Terrorist Screening Center, which is managed by a wing of the FBI. This document was prepared with representatives from across the sort of counterterrorism community, including CIA, FBI, NSA, the Pentagon. Representatives from all of those different agencies that are sort of part of this process put this together. And then it was approved by the deputies, National Security Council Deputy Committee in 2013.
And so let's go back for a moment to the reasonable suspicion. We'll read a little bit from the document. To meet the reasonable suspicion standard, the nominator, based on the totality of the circumstances, must rely upon articulable intelligence or information which, taken together with rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrants a determination that an individual is known or suspected to be or has been knowingly engaged in conduct constituting in preparation for, in aid of, or related to terrorism and terrorist activities. Okay, let's put aside that the terrorism and terrorist activities is also hugely broad, it appears. But all of these things, reasonable suspicion, articulable intelligence, rational inferences, reasonably warrants, all of these are legal standards which are generally adjudicated in courts. Who adjudicates whether or not the inference was rational or that the intelligence was articulable or that there was reasonably warranted a determination? I mean, who adjudicates that?
Well, the entire process is one without any sort of outside oversight. So all of this is happening internally, and a huge degree of sort of latitude is given to the screeners themselves. But what's important to remember is that that entire definition that you read about reasonable suspicion, there's an exception to all of it. If you don't meet the reasonable suspicion standard, there are still ways in which you can watchlist somebody. But there are exceptions to just about everything that's laid out in the guidance. So, you know, they spend a lot of time writing about what reasonable suspicion means, but then they say, if you can't meet the reasonable suspicion standard, well, here are some exceptions. Here are ways that you can get around that.
Tell us what those loopholes or exceptions are.
So, you know, some of them are, you know, family members of known or suspected terrorists. Those sorts of issues. Others include people who have a nexus to terrorist activity. Like I mentioned before, there are also two sort of designations in the TIDE database for people who are non-terrorists in this terrorist database, who are kept in there for immigration purposes, for DHS and State Department screening purposes for immigration. So there's a range of different exceptions to reasonable suspicion standards.
And you do point out that the guidelines note that certain associations, such as providing janitorial services or delivering packages, are not grounds for being watchlisted.
That one is so curious. They say it at least two times in the document, and we have no idea why they single out janitorial service. But yeah, I don't know.
And so they just cite janitorial services and delivering packages. Are there other professions or businesses that you could be engaged in which would not qualify as associations?
Those are the two that are singled out for some reason.
It's just bizarre. I mean...
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, who knows?
So if someone's in a nominating agency and they want clarification. Mm-hmm. This guy, they didn't deliver packages, but they're this suspected terrorist cleaners, let's say. Like they drop off their dry cleaning there. And I'm an agent at the FBI, and I want to put this guy on a watch list because I have reasonable suspicion about just like he goes in there a lot. He doesn't seem to wear any clothes that are pressed at any time. Who would I get guidance from as to whether or not, or would I just submit and see if it goes through?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, but I mean, what you would have there, it seems to fall into reasonable suspicion to watch list somebody, so you can send that sort of up the chain. I don't see how that sort of hypothetical would be prohibited from, sending up through the sort of watch listing chain.
In fact, you guys report that in a recent court filing, the government disclosed that there were 468,000, let's just call it 469,000 nominations, and only a little less than 5,000 were rejected. So do we have a sense of how many people are being added to this list each year? And do we have any sense of how many people in this country are on this list?
Our understanding is that there are about 200 nominations per day and about 60 records deleted per day.
Okay, so So we're adding a net 140 per day, but we don't really have a sense. I mean, if there was a 500,000 nominations, 5,000 were rejected, and about half, I guess, just if we use that algorithm, half were nominated, but then about probably another 220,000 were booted off the list in 2013. Do we have any sense of how many are on? I mean, is this the same process? Have we had this level of nomination since like 2002, or do you have a sense of that?
Well, it depends on which list you're talking about. If you're talking about No Fly, Selectee, Tide, or the watch list itself. What's really interesting, what I find personally interesting is that in 2006, CBS News acquired a copy of the No Fly list, the actual list. And at that time, it was 40,000 some names. And, you know, that came out and it was sort of scandalous. And the next year, there was this DOJ IG report that found all sorts of problems with the watch listing system, and the government decided to significantly cut down, especially the number of people on the no fly list, and that number, actually the no fly list number, continued to decrease year after year under intense pressure from the media and pressure from similar government reports. By 2009, the no fly list had actually been trimmed down to about 4,000 people, according to New York Times reporting. Then the underwear bomber happens, and the whole thing just explodes again. And now we're looking at numbers that are on par with the Bush administration.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the Tide database has just continued to expand. Some of the other lists haven't really been scaled back at all. But it hasn't been a straight increase on, for every list. By and large, the process has continued to grow under both administrations.
All right. Well, lastly, I know this report just came out yesterday, but have you seen, are you aware of anybody in Congress who are looking at this and saying, hey, wait a second, we need some reform? I mean, has there been anybody in Congress or the Senate that has been talking about reforming this? Or
we certainly haven't heard anything yet, but we hope to. I think that we're hopeful that the publication of this document, is going to help people who've been trying for years in court cases to understand why their government has labeled them a terrorist or a suspected terrorist. For years, the fight has just been completely unfair because these people on these lists have no means to know the sort of rules that the government is using. So hopefully this is a step in that direction.
Right, and perhaps we can see some court challenges based upon whether or not this level of suspicion to be marked by the government is constitutional or not. Ryan Devereaux, thanks so much for your time. We will link to your piece at majority.fm.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. All right, folks. Sorry, I know the sound quality wasn't great there. His phone was not fantastic. But God knows these guys at The Intercept. I mean, God knows, they must be like just doing their whole communications with like a cup and some string just to avoid... Good luck to Ryan Devereaux taking a flight anytime soon. That's all I can say.
Did you ever see that Bill Maher episode with Scahill and Jay Leno were on the same panel, which
no,
in and of itself was like the funniest thing
insane
I've ever seen in my life. And, Scahill's talking about, I think it was Blackwater at that point, and Leno in that like classic Leno manner is just like, you kind of surprised you haven't been killed or anything yet? It was so tasteless.
Leno,
I don't know why I thought of that. I was just like, this is like the most tasteless thing I've ever seen on television.
Leno had him on, though, on The Tonight Show, Jeremy
Scahill. Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, well, good for him. There was just something about it. He delivered it in the same way that he just kind of like, hey, you seen the paper today? It was the same, like the same type of joke of like, are you surprised you haven't been killed by the secret security apparatus that you're uncovering their war crimes in Iraq?
Yeah, what did you think about, Paris Hilton's dress on the... on the red carpet.
All right,
strange, huh?
We're gonna head into the the members half of the show. For those people who support this program, you will hear my thoughts on the whole scuttlebutt with Rula Jabril. I don't know what else to call it.
Scuttlebutt.
Well, I mean, she was on. Well, there's a question as to whether or not she was a MSNBC contributor at the time that she was on Ronan Farrow's show. And she basically articulated what I think is, you know, relatively self-evident that, but certainly unspoken, that the media is horribly unbalanced when it comes to depicting what's going on between Israel and the Palestinians. And then she subsequently tweeted that her appearances had been canceled. Then she showed up on Hayes's show for a, I guess, a debate or an interview on the same topic. And then she was on Democracy Now. I will give you my opinion of what's going on there. And it's a fairly somewhat informed opinion. I am an MSNBC contributor. It's not a terribly big deal in terms of that. So I'm not terribly worried about risking any opportunities there, but I don't have any particular inside information. Also on the member half, we will talk about this horrible execution that went awry. We got a very thoughtful email from what? Oh, jeez, what is wrong with you? We got an email from a European listener on what's going on in Ukraine.
That was a great email.
And then we also got an email from somebody who wasn't as thoughtful.
That was
well.
The email
look,
I
have no problem with people criticizing Michael in emails. That is actually the least of the issue that I take with this email. But
when Sam gets critical emails, it's like a whole emotional crisis in the office.
No,
we
no,
take
no,
care
no,
of him.
No, no, no. That's not true. Yeah. I get critical emails all the time. But there is one thing that I don't like in an email. And in fact, maybe we should do this now.
Okay. There are several things I didn't particularly like.
Well,
about
I don't mind. I don't mind anybody slagging you. I mean, I think that seems. In many respects, very justified. But this is an email from a listener, George, a member. Michael, stop repeating Israeli propaganda. Michael claimed on the show that Hamas wanted Palestinians to be killed by Israel in order to garner support of their people. Almost identical to Israel envoy claiming Hamas celebrating the deaths of Palestinians. Very Nazi-like attitude. I am very disappointed. Now, let's take that part of the email first, okay? I don't think... No, you can't say... Michael, you're going to stay out of this.
I think Michael is more Nazi than Nazi-like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... Things are getting ugly in here. All right, look. Michael did not claim on the show that Hamas wanted Palestinians to be killed by Israel in order to garner support of their people. I don't think you claim that.
Not even remotely.
Okay. What Michael said, as far as I know, and I would agree with this assessment, or let me project onto what Michael said, and you tell me, Michael, if this is accurate, that... In the same way that I believe Netanyahu and the Israeli government exploited the kidnapping of and killing of these three Israeli teenagers, in the same way that they held the information that they were probably dead and did not release the audio 911 footage of the boys being shot or the The results of an investigation that found blood on the seats, which they clearly must have known were the kids, right? In the same way that they suppressed that information and used that as a pretext, and in the same way that the Israeli government uses Hamas's firing rockets or killing civilians as a means